The days between the end of Christmas Day and the 4th of January, when many people start work or school or normal life again, whatever that means, these days can be strangely unreal. Some people are heading for the shops, either to get a bargain or possibly a refund. Selfridges took £1 million last Boxing Day. Some go to the sea, perhaps for a dip, or more often into the country for a long walk, as what British people do in the freezing cold. And others seek a more obvious comfort in the television or food or time with our families. And it is a very strange time. We're out of our norms. The routines that normally guide us are not there. But somewhere in the background, we are perhaps wondering quite what the new year, when it comes, will bring. Now, politicians in the United Kingdom know what 2010 will bring, because it's going to be the year of the general election. And so we start gathering our questions. If someone aspires to rule over us, what kind of policies will they promote? Andrew Rawnsley of the Observer newspaper, surveying the British scene, said, what is promised here is, on one hand, the axeman, and the other, the taxman. And therefore, we will have some questions. We will want to know what services they plan to cut and what taxes they will decide to raise. But as well as those sort of detailed questions, there are other questions, perhaps more important, even if they're less specific. The kind of questions that if you had the opportunity, you would want to find out about your future king or your next president or a future prime minister or a member of parliament. You want to know, who is this person, whether it's Prince Charles or David Cameron or Gordon Brown, whoever it is. Where are they coming from? What influences them? What makes them tick? What morals do they live and govern by? How do we feel they are likely to react in a crisis? What do they stand for? What stature do they have? They're a good list of questions, and whether television debates, which obviously are going to be new this time round, whether they will provide the answers, we'll have to wait and see. Now, the people in Isaiah's time were promised a ruler. And so certain was his coming that the prophet wrote as though the event had actually happened. And those people were looking forward to their Messiah. They were wondering what he was going to be like. Now, if that doesn't sound very relevant to us, it is relevant, because 2,700 years or so later, we look to the very same ruler. The one who arrived at what we call Christmas is the only one to meet those great prophetic ideals. It starts off in verse 6, "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders." I don't know how you find Christmas, particularly in relation to what we believe about Jesus Christ. It's very easy to think, well, I know about him. I just wonder whether we've ever stopped and thought about these titles that are here, these names. We love to hear them read. We love to hear them sung. But what do we know about them? We're going to find out. We're not going to have any headings. We don't need them. They're all here in verse 6. The fact that we believe in God, the fact that we believed in Jesus Christ, if we do, is one thing. But we need to know who he is and what he stands for. And it's not just true for ourselves, but other people inquiring about him, perhaps people we know, they certainly need to know. So let's take number one. He is called the Wonderful Counselor. And the one word that this seems to sum up those two words, Wonderful Counselor, is the word wisdom. I know if you were able to look on, we needn't look ourselves now in Isaiah, we get a slightly more effusive kind of description. The Lord Almighty, wonderful in counsel and magnificent in wisdom. Now, one of our greatest fears about governments is corruption. And when I talk about corruption, this isn't just about MPs' expenses, duck ponds, and all the other things we've been having serialized over the last few months. It's also about what a ruler will want to seize for themselves. Corruption can be rife in any part of the world, and crippling when it takes hold of a nation. It's the question over whether they rule to serve their own interests, or whether they rule to serve the interests of others. And the wisdom of this coming king that we read out here in verse 6, the wisdom of this coming governor was directed towards other people. And that comes very clear as we look on into verse 7. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness. The king in Isaiah's day, King Ahaz, was clever enough, but he was not wise. The most famous of all wise rulers was, of course, Solomon. In fact, Solomon chose wisdom as the gift he needed most for the task he was to take on. Let me just read to you from earlier in the Bible, which tells us a little bit about Solomon getting ready for his new assignment. He had asked for wisdom, and the Lord was pleased that Solomon had asked for this. So God said to him, "Since you have asked for this, and not for long life or wealth for yourself, nor have asked for the death of your enemies, but for discernment in administering justice, I will do what you have asked. I will give you a wise and discerning heart, so that there will never have been anyone like you, nor will there ever be." Now there's no doubt at all that the wisdom of Solomon was very impressive. The Queen of Sheba made a special trip in order to find out for herself. And when she heard the wisdom of Solomon, she was captivated. But wisdom is not there to draw attention to ourselves, to enhance our own personal reputation. Wisdom is for the people that we serve. In the last few weeks, Copenhagen brought together rulers from all over the world into one place. And they were there, as we know, to tackle a common anxiety, climate change. Now we may be a bit disappointed, some of us, about some of the results, but just being there, all those people from right across the world, it's very unusual that it happens like that. Listening and discussing together was important. But it became clear as the time went on that some represented the very wealthy nations, and others were there representing those in poverty, perhaps with much more to lose. And the Guardian said that cash, as they said, is the key to unlocking the grand climate bargain between the rich and poor worlds. And so it proved. And if it was the key, it was also the stumbling block. Justice and righteousness are the way we govern wisely. That's a message for all politicians. A country needs to be run with moral foundations. It's also a message for Christians of all walks of life. Professor Richard Borkum, I met several times when he was such a huge encouragement to young Christians studying theology in Manchester in the department where he lectured. And in a book he wrote, he devoted one chapter called Wisdom for the Powerful. And he quoted Proverbs 31 where it says, "Open your mouth, judge righteously, and maintain the rights of the poor and needy." And then in the course of the chapter he said, "For our own benefit, we do not have to be suspicious, as though this were evidence of Christian accommodation to secular thought. This ruler will be wise in the way that he rules." And as it says in Matthew's Gospel about Jesus when he came, they said, "One greater than Solomon is here. The Lord Almighty, wonderful in counsel and magnificent in wisdom." Not a wisdom to impress, but with which to rule. If you keep your finger in Isaiah 9 and you turn over a couple of pages to Isaiah 11, you'll spot this chapter, I think, is one that's in somewhere in your own recollection because it's very often read at carol services. And what it says here about the wisdom, it says the Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, verse 2, the Spirit of wisdom and of an understanding, of counsel, and the power, and so on. He will delight in the fear of the Lord. And how will he rule? He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes, or decide by what he hears with his ears, but with righteousness he will judge the needy. With justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. Great wisdom. Wonderful counselor. Number 2, mighty God. After wisdom comes power. We're looking back here at verse 6 of chapter 9. He will be called wonderful counselor, mighty God. Now the word power can set all sorts of alarm bells ringing. If corruption is one fear we have about rulers, then maybe exploitation is another. I mean, if you take, for example, there are concerns even today about the power of the supermarkets. We ask questions, what kind of a hold do they have over their customers or their local communities or their suppliers or their employees? I gather that Tesco's has about 2,000 or more stores, and it takes 1 in every £3 spent on groceries in the United Kingdom, giving it, said one commentator, astonishing economic and political power. But it's not just power in supermarkets. Alan Rusbridge, as editor of The Guardian, when he was interviewed in 2006, he said, I'm sometimes troubled by the untrammeled power of newspapers. Now, before we each start hitting out at the power of the newspapers or the banks or the supermarkets or other likely institutions, we may ourselves have to accept some responsibility for using their resources for our own interests. And yet we know that while power is in human hands, it is always risky, whereas in God's wise hands, as we've already seen, it is unselfish and pure. Alec Mateer, the commentator of parts of the Old Testament, looks at verse 7 and he sees the words where it says, talks about the increase of his government. It wasn't just going to stay where it was. The increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. But that increase is far from being a threat to the world. Mateer writes, this is an empire indeed, but there is no imperialism. There is rule, but no exploitation. But maybe for some people, when it comes to God, the fear about his power is less whether he will abuse it, but whether he has enough. That's why this title is so vital in the lineup. This job when he came, this ruler with the government on his shoulders, would be, says Isaiah, a mighty God. He would carry the strength of the Holy One of Israel. A mighty God. Gideon was one of the great famous strong men in Israel's history. In fact, there's a reference to victory over the Midianites here in verse 4. But as we look on from verse 4 and we come to verse 6, we realize that a greater than Gideon was to come. And this Jesus Christ, when he came, would deliver his people. He would save them. He would rescue them, not just from one or two difficult situations, but rescue them from being separated from God through our sin and disobedience. He is mighty to save. When sometimes we look at Jesus, we begin to realize that very often he doesn't present a very powerful image. He doesn't come across like an Alex Ferguson or a Simon Cowell. Instead, we perhaps associate Jesus Christ with quiet things like mangers and donkeys. And certainly that is important. This was his humility. But that humility should never be taken as excuse for thinking he had a lack of strength or power. Perhaps you remember during the trial of Jesus by the Roman governor, Pilate. Pilate telling Jesus that he reminded the prisoner, power to crucify him. And Jesus, who was bound hand and foot, puts the record straight. He just says to him, you would have no power over me at all if it had not been given you from above. I just fear sometimes that Jesus still carries that mild, gentle, ineffective image. An image that suggests that some people, perhaps, that he would not be able to stand up to the real strong men and women of the world. And that's why this title is so vital, included in this list of four. It tells us that he is no pushover. He is the strong man. He is the mighty God. And so we come to number three, Everlasting Father. After wisdom, after power, comes love. Now, there's a lot of pointing the fingers at what is often called short-term politics. The fear is, perhaps, that people have been given what we want rather than always what we need. And this short-term politics is often criticized because on one hand it's very temporary and on the other hand it's popularist. It keeps rulers in power, or they think so, or in the running for power in the short term. Now, where that is the case, and I'm not suggesting all politics is like that, it is so different from what we read about the king who is to come, the ruler who is to come as Jesus Christ. He would not simply last for a term of office. His name was Everlasting. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. We need to somehow grasp that, even though it's beyond all that we can take in as human beings. Everlasting. And the coming king would not relate to his people only as his subjects, but also as his children. His name was Father. Kings in Old Testament days were never referred to as Father, but this one was. Because he was wanting not only to rule his people, but to be in relationship with them. You may have read a book which was first published a while ago, I certainly read it some time ago, about the personal experiences of someone called Bilquis Sheikh. Let me just tell you what it says on the back cover, just so you have an idea of what the book is about. It talks about Bilquis. Searching in the Quran, she found references to the prophet Jesus. So she turned to the pages of the Christian Bible to see if they could shed more light on this mysterious figure. At the same time, a series of strange dreams launched her on a quest that would bring her to crisis point. Was Islam still the right way for her? Or could God be known more personally? Her decision would change her life forever. And this is just a little quotation from inside the book itself. She says, "No Muslim, I felt certain, ever thought of Allah as Father. And yet Dr. Santiago's words came to me again. Talk to God, talk to him as if he were your father." And suddenly a breakthrough of hope flooded me. If my earthly father would put aside everything to listen to me, wouldn't my heavenly father? Shaking with excitement, I got out of bed, sank to my knees on the rug, looked up to heaven, and in rich new understanding, called God my Father. And that word to describe God describes Jesus, his love. The new king would, says verse 7, reign forever. He would reign on David's throne. David, Israel's finest king, would one day have the successor that Israel and the world needed. And that king would be born in Bethlehem, in David's town. And he was born there as one way for us to recognize him as the promised Messiah of Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 6, the Everlasting Father. And so we come to number four, Prince of Peace. The lineup, we've got it now, is a whole wisdom and power and love and peace. Now, governments today struggle with the whole business of war. We can actually sense that as Tony Blair, of course, is under scrutiny about Iraq. And President Obama felt it necessary to defend the use of force when receiving the Nobel Peace Prize just a couple of weeks ago. And as we look down this list here and we get to peace, we realize that although on one hand we look to our rulers for strength against the enemy, we also look towards them for being peaceful. And then we ask, well, quite then, what is this Prince of Peace all about? Now, if we were to look through this book here, it's quite a long book, we are given two pictures in Isaiah. And both these pictures of peace reveal the long-term realization of a perfect peace that will come in the last days. If you have a look at that chapter we were looking at a moment ago in chapter 11 and verse 6, so that's a couple of pages, 696, verse 6. This picture depicts the animal world at peace. The wolf will live with the lamb, the leopard will lie down with the goat, the calf and the lion and the yearling together, and a little child will lead them. The cow will feed with the bear. Their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox. The infant will play near the hole of the cobra, and the young child put his hand into the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. But also in Isaiah, you don't need to look at this, but I would just tell you that there is another picture. And this second picture describes the perfect peace, not for the animal kingdom this time, but for human society. It says that in those days he will judge between the nations, and he will settle disputes for many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. Interesting that when Micah has a very similar theme in his prophecy, he adds then a very homely result of all this. He says, in those days everyone will sit under his own vine and under his own fig tree, and no one will make them afraid. No roadside bombs, no guns or knives. Perfect peace. The question is, if that feels like a rather distant reality, then it's not surprising, because we don't live in that perfect world at this time. So what are we to make of these promises now? What are we to do about them? Let me make two suggestions. The first is very simple. If we follow the Prince of Peace, make peace our aim. Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers. When President Obama was giving his speech on receiving his prize, he referred to a number of people from the past. Peacemakers in their particular situation, like Martin Luther King. And a quotation from him. Luther King said, violence never brings permanent peace. It solves no social problems. It merely creates new and more complicated ones. Jimmy Carter, a former United States president, collected his Peace Prize in 2002. And in his speech, he said, war sometimes may be a necessary evil. But no matter how necessary, it is always an evil and never a good. We will not learn to live together in peace by killing each other's children. But peace is not just for us to seek in the international or political arena. In our homes, family, at work, this is our responsibility. It's not an easy thing to deal with. I'm sure people like presidents and prime ministers struggle. May look easy to us, the job they do. They must struggle with the whole business of violence and the need to create peace, sometimes through going to war. But we can learn a lot from people like Nelson Mandela. He was asked how he could work alongside de Klerk in South Africa when the two men were trying to bring about some sort of reconciliation at the end of apartheid. I'm sure neither man found it a very comfortable experience. They were coming from very different places. But afterwards, Mandela said about their relationship, and it's a very helpful bit of advice to us. He said, to make peace with an enemy, one must work with that enemy. And that enemy becomes your partner. Make peace our aim. And then there is another suggestion here that's very simply, we take Christ, our peace. When we get into the New Testament and we look very carefully at Jesus Christ, we're always drawn to the cross. And when we get to the cross, we find that Christ is there, our peace. Relationships with each other are so important, but peace with God. Have you had that? It's not just about becoming a quieter person without a trouble in the world. It's not that kind of peace. This is the peace that can make each of us into a whole person, a complete person. It's not a peace that we will ever achieve by our own efforts. This peace is the gift of God that comes only through the Prince of Peace. And I just wonder, if you sense that you're ending 2009, and we haven't got very far to go, without having received that peace that comes only through Jesus Christ, that reconciled us with God, then we will find that we're ending the year unfulfilled and incomplete. Make peace our aim. Take Christ, our peace. And so just to finish off, how does life look? If we have got that in the back of our minds, how does it look when we peer around the corner into 2010? When the prophet announced these amazing names, these great titles of the ruler who was to be born, he said for those who heard it that this had transformed everything for them. The people who walked in darkness, he said, have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. I wonder what kind of darkness we're ever walking in. I think all of us are walking in the darkness of global crisis. This is nothing new. Assyria was deporting inhabitants, as we see in there in verse 1, all those centuries ago. And today we have our problems, terrorism on planes, war, inability to solve long-running disputes in the Middle East that now tend to threaten every part of the globe. And as we look round the corner into 2010, we don't know how the political and international landscape will develop. No doubt we will have our own small parts to play. But what we do know is that in the darkness, there is light. Because of the child who was born, the son who was given. We can't predict or even see each stage in the future, but we now know how it will all end because of who that child is. So we have the darkness of global crisis, but we also have the darkness of personal uncertainty. Somebody was saying to me not all that long ago that living in uncertainty is always a very difficult thing, and it is. We cannot predict or program our lives. Perhaps we discover that. Maybe we look back over 2009 and we think of all the things we could never have imagined would have happened to us in this past year. It reminds us as we look into the future that our financial security or our employment future or our own personal health or the health of our friends and family, we just don't know what's to come. But in the shadows that sometimes cast their darkness over our lives, and not knowing precisely what 2010 will produce for us, in that darkness we have seen a great light. And he is each of these things. Jesus Christ is the wonderful counselor promised. He is the mighty God. He is the everlasting Father. And he is the Prince of Peace. And so as we get to the corner and we look ahead, we can ourselves say, the Lord is my light and my salvation. Of whom shall I be afraid?